right, buddy. Welcome to the Dimebag Podcast. I am Tyler Wilkinson. I'm joined today by Megan Bard.
Hello.
And Russ Steinberg.
Hello.
You are about to hear a fun interview with Senator Chris Murphy, who was kind enough to join us, talk about some NCAA issues, some baseball, some UConn history, some wings, some walking, a lot of good stuff. So I hope you enjoy it. And here's our interview with Senator Murphy. So our guest today is the junior senator from the great state of Connecticut. He's a graduate of UConn Law, an avid fan of the Huskies, and a frequent, some might say dedicated, reader of adimeback.com, as evidenced by him tweeting one of our articles twice, which is pretty good, pretty good.
I couldn't tell whether Russ was mad that I was trying to play off your content as my own, or whether he was excited that I was
Russ is excited, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. Absolutely. Right. No question.
You guys do awesome work. Thanks for it. I'm excited to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it, Senator.
Thank you.
So the reason we're talking to you today is because you just put out a report through your office. I have the title here. It's called Madness, Inc. And it's basically a report about all of the ways that student athletes are getting money sort of withheld from them while everyone else around college sports gets rich. So, Senator, can you tell us sort of what brought this report to your office and what the scope of the report entails?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm a big sports fan. I played sports growing up, wasn't good enough to compete intercollegiately, follow sports closely today. And yeah, I can't have helped but notice how big the business of college athletics has become. And in the last 15 years, it's tripled in size. The amount of money that, you know, the college athletic programs take in today alone is $14 billion. And that probably means that the overall size of the college sports industry is 2 to 3 times that size. And so as the amount of money has been getting gargantuan, moves back and forth between college athletic programs and the private sector, it just has seemed more unconscionable to me that the students are getting absolutely nothing out of this when it's really their efforts, their labors, that are making the money for all of the adults. And so, you know, in my mind, this just all hit a tipping point at some point when these billion-dollar TV contracts started becoming normalized, when, you know, Power Five football schools started installing recording studios and mini golf courses in their facilities. And then when you continue to hear stories about, you know, kids who, you know, literally are scraping together from one meal to the other during the summer, or this tournament where a story broke in which a University of Houston player couldn't afford to have his parents come to see him play because it's illegal for the NCAA to try to help parents of players come to games. And yet, you know, the University of Houston, no doubt, you know, had all of its big corporate backers flying into the first round on, you know, their corporate jets. And so it just makes no sense any longer that everybody's getting rich off of college athletics except for these kids. And by the way, we shouldn't be shy about noting that, especially in the sports that make the money, basketball and football, these are largely African-American kids. And the coaches and the CEOs of the big sports companies, they are largely white. And so when, you know, that disparity exists, you know, you got to call it a civil rights issue. And I've tweeted about this occasionally. I've been complaining privately to anybody that would listen about this for years, but I just felt like I needed to spend some more time trying to draw this out, and that's why I issued this report this week.
I'm glad you mentioned the civil rights aspect of this, and especially race, because it's something we've talked about before. I think at one point you mentioned the breakup of the players is predominantly minority, but then the further up you go the ladder of college sports, from coaching and especially in the administrative ranks, it is overwhelmingly white. I guess the thing that I've always wondered about this issue is why more people who generally side on the side of liberal, liberal issues or civil rights or pro-labor are so slow to come around on this issue.
Yeah, I guess I don't have the answer to that question, except to say that, you know, here in Congress, the Congressional Black Caucus has been active on this issue. I think they actually have a task force that works on this issue of trying to represent and scale up the rights of largely African-American player base in college football and college basketball. So it is something that is gaining more and more attention. But again, I think the size of the industry has snuck up on people. Again, it's happened really fast. It really has. I mean, as much as we've been all watching, in Connecticut, right? We've been obsessed with college sports and college basketball in particular for decades. But the ramp up really has been in the last 10 to 15 years. And so I think, the whole political infrastructure is catching up. Right now, I may be the leading edge of this criticism, but I do think that in real time, we're finding more and more people figuring out, how students are getting screwed here.
Do you find that with all the lawsuits that are going through the court system right now, the NCAA has taken a few losses, but none that are sort of the death blow to their amateurism structure, plus, the FBI investigation that's leading to some indictments. Do you sort of feel the window opening on this issue a little bit?
I do. Who knows whether these antitrust claims will, there's a claim that just come through district court, which says that these players have no option other than the NCAA. And so the NCAA is violating antitrust rules because they're a monopoly. If a college athlete doesn't like the rules of the NCAA, they don't have the option to go play for any other college athletic organization. So that's an antitrust violation. I do think the scandals, also have opened people's eyes. And then, listen, I think the Zion Williamson thing really did, take this conversation to the next level because, there was a day or so there where people really had to grapple with, what does it say about college sports if this kid can't ever play again? And, everybody got to make a ton of money off of him.
Right.
And yet he was potentially not going to make a dime. And people looked at, Nike's market cap dropping by $1 billion in a day from an amateur athlete. And, I think that did open some people's eyes to the unfairness of this. And it's part of the reason why I frankly decided to, expedite, raising awareness on it.
So with these reports, and this is the first in a series that you've released, what's the overarching goal? Is there going to be, in your mind, a policy outcome at the end of this, or is it more of an awareness and trying to shape the public narrative?
I mean, I'm not excited about the prospect of Congress micromanaging the relationship between, colleges, athletic departments, and their players. This is much better taken care of by the NCAA. So my hope is that these reports are going to open people's eyes to the fundamental unfairness of the existing system and put pressure on the NCAA and these schools to, come up with some new plans of how they can share the billions of dollars that are going to everybody except for the players with the players. I fully admit in this report and every interview that I do, it's complicated, right? There's legitimate real questions about how you would compensate players. But the existing system is super complicated and convoluted. The restrictions that we put on players as to what they can do and what they can't do, the ways in which the sneaker companies make money legally and illegally is complicated. So, don't tell me that you can't figure out a way to share any of this money with the players just because it's complicated, because you found a way to share billions of dollars with lots of people who aren't the players in a pretty complicated and confusing way too.
Yeah, one of the things that's always bothered us has been sort of the lack of representation that the student athletes have, especially if you go everything not only for compensation, but down to disciplinary action. Ryan Boatwright famously at UConn got in some trouble, essentially because his mom was mixed up with some plane tickets and all this stuff, but he had no recourse to even challenge it, let alone legal representation or anything else. Some people's solution is unionization of NCAA athletes. Where do you fall on that?
I mean, I certainly support the right of anybody to be able to unionize. I don't, discriminate against, folks that are playing for basketball teams and making lots of money for their schools, or, people that are, working at a restaurant or a manufacturing plant. So, absolutely, they should have the ability to stand together. I mean, I get it that there's a difficult conversation here about whether they're employees or they're not employees, but they are making a whole lot of money. A bunch of people who have a lot of control over their lives. And they should be able to participate in the gains of their labors. And one of the ways that you can do that is by negotiating together. And you're right, they just don't have the ability to do that. And there's really no incentive to you know, stand out and speak up. You know, we saw what happened to professional athletes who try to stand up and speak out. There's a lot of lessons to be learned by younger athletes that they're maybe better off to just stay quiet and let the behemoth of the NCAA have its way.
Senator, there was one stat in this that really kind of jumped off the page at me, because a lot of this conversation is around, well, the kids get these scholarships, and doesn't that have this tremendous value? But in your report, you point out that $936 million a year goes towards student aid, while annually coaches are getting $1.2 billion out of this pool. And of course, the coaches' pool is much smaller than the players' pool. So to me, you know, it sort of underscored the point that, like, there is a lot of money to go around. It's just not, it's not trickling down to the kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, you know, the stat that is going to really shock people. Let me just break it down for you a little bit more. So you have 45,000 athletes at the Power Five schools, 45,000, and they get $936 million in tuition aid. You have 4,000 coaches at those same schools. So you have 10% the number of coaches, and they get more money. So you have 10%, you know, the coaches are a small percentage of the athletes, and yet they're getting most of the money. And that's the unfairness here, is that, you know, when you look at all of the money that these schools are collecting, you know, they will come into congressional offices and say, no, we are compensating students. We are providing them with an education. Yeah, but you're giving them this tiny slice of the pie, and you're giving the rest to people that are, you know, buying mansions and boats with that money. And so don't tell me that you can't afford to spend a little bit more, at the very least, at the outset, on those students, many of which, you know, by the way, are not getting the kind of education you would hope for, because, as we will talk about in future reports, many of these athletes look very much like professional athletes in the amount of time that they're forced to spend in order to compete. And so they don't have all the advantages that should come with a free scholarship, because they're spending all of their time keeping in game shape, traveling, training, so that they can make money for the school. And maybe they have a little bit of time on the side to learn, but not as much as I did right, as a student.
And I think and that's just talking about the money within the school. That doesn't even touch on the endorsements, when Nike or Adidas makes a huge contract and pays Rick Pitino, you know, tens of millions of dollars. Nobody on his team is getting any of that money, even though people go out, buy a jersey because it's got Zion Williamson's number on it. Zion Williamson had to sign away his name and his likeness to be able to play for the school.
And, like, Pitino's not wearing those sneakers.
Right.
So nobody, you know, Pitino is, I mean, that's sort of the most egregious, you know, facet of college sports today, is that, you know, these coaches are literally are making money off of these students' feet, right?
Right.
Nobody's wearing them. Nobody's buying the sneaker because Rick Pitino endorses the sneaker. They're buying the sneaker because they're on the feet of these players who people follow and want to emulate. So the fact that none of these kids get any of that money, and very few of them go on to become professionals, you know, is really maybe the worst of the current system.
Senator, what do you make of the NCAA's sort of counterpoint to all of these conversations? And they've made this argument in court that amateurism is sort of paramount to their business model, that without unpaid players, interest in the sports would diminish.
Well, I mean, they are not supposed to be in the business of marketing a product. They are a nonprofit association that is supposed to be in the business of helping students. And so if their argument is that we would make less money if we paid the kids, that's going to fall on a whole lot of deaf ears here in Congress. They are supposed to be working in the best interests of the schools and the kids. And so the idea that, you know, they wouldn't make as much money if they paid the kids, that's probably true. But that's not what's supposed to, the NCAA is supposed to be about. The commercialization of this nonprofit organization is beyond the point of defense any longer. You know, when those nets are cut down, that ladder that the kids climb up on is going to have a sponsor slapped on the side of it. Maybe they wouldn't get a sponsor for the ladder if they had, if they had to pay some of these kids, but you know, that's a small price to pay.
And I do sometimes wonder too, if there's, you know, like we live in Connecticut, you know, there, I am sure there are local people who would love to hire, you know, Katie Lou Samuelson to do a commercial for their car dealership, but like she can't do that. There is a market for that, and none of these athletes can tap into it.
Right, but everybody else can. Right?
Everybody else can.
So,
yeah.
So everybody else can. So the coaches can tap into that market. You know, the shoe companies can, and the apparel companies can use the kids in order to tap into the market. Everybody else can make money except for these kids. Now, listen, again, there are tough questions posed by the next steps here, right? And I leave it to people smarter than me to figure out how you start to make the system more fair without opening the floodgates to abuse overnight. But the fact that the NCAA isn't even trying, to sit down and figure out how you square the moral injustice of what's happening today is what is unacceptable to me. We have to at least prompt them to start a real conversation, which they're not having now.
Yeah, and you know, even just a year ago when the news of the FBI investigation broke, the NCAA formed this commission, spent a whole bunch of time reviewing their policies, especially around recruiting, and ultimately came up with a bunch of changes that I think experts around the game agreed isn't going to change the recruiting game very much at all, isn't going to change, illicit dealings to get players to certain schools, things like that. Is that simply because the NCAA does not want to change that, because that would mean doing away with amateurism and letting players profit?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of the incentive structure that exists today for compensating students through the back door is that you're not compensating them through the front door. And so when you're dealing with a family in need that, you know, literally can't afford to put food on the table, who are told that their kid is going to be shipped off, you know, 200 miles away, not be around to help provide for the family, in fact, be restricted from being able to provide for the family, there unfortunately becomes an incentive for people to try to do end arounds. And so if you did find a way to more justly compensate the students, you'd have a great disincentive for the kind of illegal sort of backdoor compensation that still happens in and around the recruitment process.
Senator, I want to get you, we'll talk about some fun UConn stuff in a minute, but just to get us there, I guess sort of from the UConn fan standpoint of this topic, you know, they see that UConn is reporting a $40 million loss from their athletic department this year. I think it probably feels difficult for some to square how UConn, who is losing that much money operating under the normal system, is going to be able to find a way to compensate players. What would your response to that be?
Well, again, this has got to be part of the conversation. There's profitability in NCAA sports, even though there are a handful of schools that are wildly profitable. But those handful of schools are wildly profitable because they are the haves. They are the winners. And the only way that you become a have or a winner is to have have-nots and to have folks who don't win as much. And so the entire ecosystem bears responsibility for this injustice. And so I don't know, you know, how you would end up pooling together money in order to provide more adequate compensation, but there is certainly a way to do that in a way that recognizes that the schools have done very well off of this system, may need to do a little bit more in order to make sure we create a fair system across the board. So yeah, again, none of this is easy. And it begs the question as to whether the goal in the end should be to make athletic programs profitable or not. If this really is, you know, a not-for-profit endeavor that's being carried out in the best interest of the students rather than as a money-making venture, you know, maybe we shouldn't cast judgment on schools that don't make as much money as other schools do. But today, you know, we tend to think that the schools that make the most money are the best athletic programs, and I'm not actually sure that that's true.
So, transitioning a little bit, tell us your UConn fandom origin story. How did you become a Husky fan?
So, Scott Burrell to Tate George. Uh-huh. You know, I was already a fan. I mean, I grew up, with Earl Kelly and some of the earlier UConn greats, but before UConn had made the leap. So, you know, I was a teenager when Calhoun took over the team, and I just will never, ever forget sitting in my family's newly renovated basement. We had just installed a big screen TV and a nice comfy couch, and I was sitting down there as a high school sophomore the night of the Clemson game when UConn ran up a huge lead. It felt like they were running away from it. They played their first and second round games at Hartford, and I actually gone to both of them. They beat BU and Cal in the first and second round, and they ran it up on Clemson, and Clemson came all the way back. They had this, obviously, now iconic play to win the game. And then I went off to some like student conference that weekend in a place where I couldn't watch the Duke game. And so this is of course before smartphones. And so throughout the conference, all of the kids there like me who are huge UConn fans were scrambling to find information about that game, which of course ended in heartbreak. But that was my sort of, that's where I became a rabid UConn fan. It was that year, all those greats, the Dub Hennefelds, just an amazing team. Long ago, before your time.
That's my origin story too. I'm older than I look, but I was 8 when that happened.
For the record, that's before my time.
That's a long-winded origin story.
It's the good one.
It's a great year.
I have a feeling a lot of people who are watching around that time share the same origin story. It was a pretty remarkable moment.
I went to my first game in a car seat in 1981.
Yeah, I've been obsessed ever since. Obviously, I've been as excited to follow the women's rise. Have gotten the chance to get to know some of my heroes. I'm about the same age as Rebecca Lobo, and she's obviously settled in at ESPN, and has been a big part of Connecticut's sort of civic and cultural fabric. And so I've gotten the chance to know her, and so it's a thrill to, now be in the position I'm in to get to know some of the people that I've watched. There was a portion of my life where, the quality of my days, were directly connected to whether the UConn basketball team had won the night before. I maybe have other things going on in my life today that dictate my emotions on a daily basis, more so than basketball. But there was a period of time in which I was hooked in by IV to, to people like, to everybody that Jim Calhoun brought into the program.
So when now the, a few years later, obviously looking at the program, how do you sort of feel about the current state of the athletic program?
Yeah, they're trying to deal with the hand that they've been dealt. And, at some point in these reports, I think I will get around to talking about the issue of conference realignment and the cartel structure that has become the Power Five. I think it's part of the big business here, in which you have essentially locked out some schools, especially in the football context, from ever being able to compete. I mean, the idea that you can go undefeated in football in a mid-major conference and have no access to the national championship structure, there's some fundamental unfairness in that. Not as big an unfairness as exists in the way that students are screwed. It's obviously it's obviously a disadvantage for UConn to be playing in the conference they are today versus the conferences they've been in the past. But I don't know, the AAC's basketball, success this year was pretty substantial. They've obviously had some pretty outstanding football teams. And I'm excited about Dan Hurley. I'm excited about, Geno's continued ability to attract the best recruits. And I still follow it pretty closely.
If you could get a federal law passed that Geno's never allowed to retire, that would really help us out a lot.
I know. I don't know. He still looks younger than me, so he's not allowed to go anywhere anytime soon.
If Geno were to run for governor, how much does he win by?
I mean, I don't think he went. I don't think that's really a question because no one else would be on the ballot. you know, Randy probably get the Republican nomination, the Democratic nomination, the Green Party nomination, and you know, sail the victory. His job is hard. I'm pretty sure he doesn't. He doesn't want that one.
Mixing sports and politics a little bit, and we'll get into a little fun lightning round stuff, but Jim Calhoun endorsed you for your first senatorial run back in, was it 2010, 2012?
Yeah, he did in 2012.
I remember seeing him at a rally at Union Station in Hartford, speak very glowingly of you. I was just wondering, as a big UConn fan, what was that like?
It was really thrilling, you know, to have his political support. And I got to know each other over the course of that campaign. He had come to, you know, an event or two that I had done. We had spoken on the phone, and I think he, you know, sort of liked the things I was talking about. And I was really, really excited to have his support. I have a hint of what Jim thinks about this whole issue of NCAA amateurism, and so I'd be interested to get his take once this report gets released more broadly. But yeah, it's been a fun friendship, and we've gotten the chance to keep it up. We talk on the phone every so often to, you know, catch up on political topics and non-political topics.
Is he telling you to get us out of the war in Yemen?
He is not. That is sort of an unspoken agreement. I have never offered him basketball advice, and he doesn't offer me many specific weedy critiques of my political priorities.
Fair enough. We're gonna try to do this a little fast, spur of the moment.
I don't know that I can respond as quickly, but
we'll find out. Who's the best UConn player of all time?
Ray Allen.
Who's your favorite UConn player of all time?
Marcus Williams.
Wow. Friend of the site, Marcus Williams. He's going to be pretty happy about that.
I don't know much about Marcus Williams personally, but he was an absolute joy to watch play. He obviously had a lot of great players to distribute the ball to, but yeah. I was mesmerized by, I just never seen anybody pass the ball like that. And then once he was able to shoot the three a little bit later in his career, that was just, you know, it was a knockout to watch.
So who was the one guy when you were growing up that you emulated or at least idolized?
At UConn or like sports in general?
Well, I meant at UConn, but you can give us whatever you want.
Well, I wanted to be Carlton Fisk growing up. So
okay.
I wanted to be a major league baseball catcher. But Scotty Burrell was somebody that was, you know, generally around, you know, he was maybe 5 years older than I was. And so, you know, he would have been an older kid in my neighborhood. And so he was somebody that I was really fascinated by when I was first becoming a big UConn fan.
That's right. Nice local guy too.
Yeah, that's right.
And aren't you a catcher right now? I mean, you know, you don't have to be humble.
I'm still a catcher.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? We play this congressional baseball game every year, like hardball, not softball. And for 10 years, I've been the catcher, only because I'm the only Democrat in Congress who can squat down and get back up.
Yeah, this is the benefit.
For like 10 years now, so I'm glad that I still get slaps.
What restaurant in Connecticut has the best wings?
Has the best wings? I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm a sucker for J. Timothy's in Plainville. They have pretty fantastic wings. I don't know that my politics match up with the owners of J. Timothy's, but they make great wings, and I go there all the time.
Well, that was a trick question because they sponsor this site and this podcast, so
you
just earned big points. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That was a trick. That was a setup.
I did not know that.
You passed the test.
They have awesome. J. Timothy's is one of the places that when people are visiting from out of town, I like to show them because it's iconic. It's a landmark. It's historical, but they've got freaking great food.
And in your old Fifth District haunting grounds, right?
It is. Yeah, that's right.
My district. Yeah. I grew up 5 minutes from J. Timothy's. Yeah.
Did you? Yeah. Well, I ran a political campaign. My first job out of college was running a political campaign out of an office in Plainville. So that's how I discovered it. Now that I live in Cheshire and a lot of my friends live in Hartford, that will sometimes be our meeting point in between.
All right. Well, anytime perfect. You need us there, just give us like 5 minutes notice and you let us know.
By the way, like I'm nailing this. J. Timothy's is your sponsor. And yeah. Marcus Williams is a friend of the show.
Yeah.
I swear I didn't know any of this.
If you say something good about the Yard Goats right now,
do you want to run our site?
Yeah, they're literally our only other sponsor.
Right. It should be your business manager. Yeah.
You're hired.
Yeah, we could use one.
Yeah, I had one. You have to pick the goat, Diana Taurasi or Breanna Stewart.
It's Taurasi, I guess, just because of the. I don't know. You get a little bit extra for attitude, right?
Absolutely.
I remember which one it was, but the weakest team she had, it might have been her last team or second to last team, but I just remember that final or that semifinal game where she just literally like carried the team down the end. So it's a tough call, but I'll give it to Taurasi.
Fair enough.
All right. I got one more with opening day tomorrow, and I've seen your tweets during baseball season, so I have to ask, why will this be the year that the Yankees win the World Series?
It'll be our
all Yankees fans.
It'll be our bullpen. That's going to be our downfall.
Fair enough.
This is like tried and true, like Red Sox front offices that they win and they convince themselves that they just need to bring back the same guys, which sometimes works, but they're going to miss Kimbrel more than they think. I don't know, man. I would not want to trust Giancarlo Stanton in any big at bat in the postseason. So good luck trusting him and Gary Sanchez to big moments in the postseason. That may be your own curse that you're going to have to deal with.
Brutal. Wow, just a vicious takedown for us.
Ooh. Yeah, sorry. I should have added
to it.
We're doing so well.
It's fine.
Sorry, go
real
ahead,
quick.
Man.
I'm a huge fan of your walk across Connecticut. I love it every year. Are you already planning it? Do you know where you're going yet?
I don't. I've been totally thinking about it. Last year, in part because I was in the middle of a campaign season, I did north to south. And so I'm figuring out now whether I'm going to do north to south again or east to west. But no, the answer is I'm definitely doing it again at some point this summer, date to be decided. And I have not picked out the route yet. But it's maybe the most fun, my most favorite thing to do every year. I get to see the state through a totally different lens, and I just meet all sorts of people that are totally apolitical, would never talk to me if I didn't show up at their gas station or their corner store in t-shirts and shorts. And so I just shorts, and so I feel like I just learned so much. I'll definitely do it again sometime this summer.
All right, Senator, last question, because we can't let you go without sneaking in a 2020 question, obviously. So what conference will UConn be in 2020?
I think we're going to, I imagine we'll still be in the AAC. I know there's a little bit of a movement to, bring us back to the Big East for basketball. But I'm as much as I, will know the difference between the conference we're in and the conference we've been in, there's promise. I'm an eternal optimist about everything in life and to watch, what, Houston has been able to do, to see what a lot of these schools continue to, these Florida schools continue to be able to do on the basketball and football side. We can compete and have a national presence in this conference. Maybe that's not the future, but there's no reason why we can't be a great basketball school and a pretty good football school inside the AAC.
All right, we'll let you go on that. Senator Chris Murphy, thank you so much for joining us today. People should read your report, Madness Inc., about the inequities in college sports. They can also follow you on Twitter, @ChrisMurphyCT. Anything else we need to plug? I think we got it.
I'm good.
All right. Thanks again, Senator. Appreciate it.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Dimeback Podcast. Until next time, we'll see you later.